Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and it's time for ScaryCast. This is Dr. John Stamey, live in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. I want to say hello, of course, to our co-hosts tonight. We're glad to have them. First of all, from Hollywood, California, Devin Tate, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Been a busy week full of a lot of music and stuff, but glad to be here on the show with you.
We are glad to have you. We got a blockbuster tonight, I'll tell you that. And
yeah.
Our buddy from Central South Carolina, Robin McRae, how are you doing tonight? You there, Robin? Hello? Oh, it says hold time. It's like she didn't come on. I'll bring her back on. I hope, is Robin there now?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Perfectly, perfectly.
John?
Glad to have you with us.
Yeah, it was like I was talking, you just couldn't hear me.
I know. Well, we're getting everything worked out. I think our platform's getting better. They have gone through a huge upgrade. I got the email, so I think we're in better shape now. And Tony, our guest, I'll do the quick introduction. Tony Filosi, paranormal investigator, Bigfoot explorer, and everything from Harlan, Kentucky. How you doing tonight, Tony?
I'm doing wonderful. How you guys doing?
Good. So glad to have you here. Devin and I were mentioning some of the problems we had last week as we were closing down ScaryCast.
Yeah.
And he said, well, what happened? I said, wait till we get the show started, and I'll tell you. It seemed as though something didn't want us to continue talking. Is that correct, Robin?
No. Oh, I agree, and I'm not quite sure it wanted me on the show either tonight, because right as I went to call in, I got a scream from Jan Carter, who's staying at my house temporarily, and we had a Bigfoot in the front yard. So I almost didn't make it.
Oh my goodness.
Oh, come on. Is that the excuse? You had a Bigfoot in the front. How's the Bigfoot tonight?
Yes. He ducked behind my car and he was sitting back there, and the poor thing, he's trying to figure out how to get out of there. So all you'd see every now and then is his head. He'd raise his head up and you'd see the top. He had a conical head. You could see the top of his head. Then he'd dunk down. You know? I'm like, no, I've been here all day, nothing. Now I'm going to be busy, and now this is what goes on.
Of course, that's the way it is. Well, we're so glad we're so glad to have you back here. It was a lot of fun last week. I was up in beautiful, scary
that
Lake Montana.
That was
Montana.
Interesting, Devin. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, it was great talking to you, too. I'm glad you're back with us.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, because I had this nifty idea. And once I talked with Tony, because Tony is going to be one of the featured speakers at the Tennessee Bigfoot Conference, which is the weekend of the 25th through the 27th in Kingsport, Tennessee, at beautiful Bays Mountain Park, right up on top of Bays Mountain. It's a beautiful place. Everybody should just come. I don't know if we're going to have all the great leaf turning and all the great colors, but it's still beautiful up there, and you can take the barge, you can ride on the lake, and that's what I want everyone to do. It's just so much fun, and Bobby Bigfoot will be there, our new Bobby Bigfoot, constructed by the wonderful Kip Ramey from Cornelia, Georgia. Everybody will get to meet Bobby. He's about 7 feet tall, and he's made out of plywood, and he's my new best friend. He goes with me everywhere I go.
I can't wait, because Kip made a Bigfoot birdhouse, and I got it when we were in Cherokee, and I love it. Absolutely love that thing. He did such a good job.
Oh, yeah. He's such a great craftsman and such a fine artist. We're just so glad to have him. And Robin will be there along with Janice Carter. And now this is at Georgia Bigfoot. It'll be Robin and Janice. And of course, Dr. Igor Burtsev. Can't wait to see Igor again. And we'll have the Chief Squatchers. And I will be there. Matt Delph will be there. Bunch more.
In Georgia, Don Tart will be there, and so will William Henry. William Henry will also be in Tennessee. Don won't be able to make that one, but William is planning on it. So that'll be great. They've got some great information.
That's great. And our buddy Royce Beggs from The Walking Dead, 7 seasons, he will be there on Saturday. Royce is cool. In fact, Royce is going to be on the show here in a couple weeks, so that'll be fun. So we just got a lot of great things happening here on ScaryCast. It's good to be back in the saddle after that difficult summer out on the boardwalk in Myrtle Beach, but it was a great summer, and I was glad to be there with Cody Haynes, Carolina Caricatures. I'm so glad to be back in the saddle here right in front of the old, when I say old, I've got a 207-year-old desk that I'm sitting in front of, so I'm back in front of the old desk. Oh, yeah, I like this thing so much. It's great. I wouldn't have another. So anyway, tonight we've got Tony Filosi. So glad to have him. And Tony will be with us. A little pre-announcement here. And I hope Robin will be with us in April as we unveil the Kentucky Bigfoot Conference. I'm about to get everything situated, Tony, and I'll give you some dates and times and places, and hopefully you can come up with us to Lexington, Kentucky. How does that sound?
Absolutely, I'd love to.
Yep, we'll probably have to have you be a featured speaker there too, because you might be telling the Manzo Shepherd story. You might be telling that for a long, long time. So why don't you get us started? We were talking about, because you do a lot of Bigfoot research, and a good buddy of yours is Thomas Markham. He's very well known up there. But
he's a nice guy. I like Thomas.
He is a good guy, but you always talk about the other paranormal stuff that you do. And we were talking either yesterday or today, I can't remember which. And you were telling me that you were doing a ghost hunt. You were going to do a reenactment of something. And I said, oh, Thomas, if you're available, you got to come hang out with us on ScaryCast and tell us about Manzo Shepherd. So I'm going to turn the floor over to you. Give us the story of one of the most shocking and horrific murders, double murders, in the state of Kentucky, right in your hometown of Harlan.
Yes. Manzo Shepherd, this happened in late April 1942. Manzo Shepherd was a nefarious character. He had been in and out of trouble all his young life. Manzo was only 24 when he died. And I've drawn some parallels between kind of Manzo Shepherd and Clyde Barrow. Whenever, especially around here in the 30s, there wasn't a lot of television, but there was a whole lot of radio and newspapers. Manzo would have been 14, 16 years old whenever all of the gangsters were being romanticized, like Bonnie and Clyde, Pretty Boy Floyd, John Dillinger, Babyface Nelson, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I kind of believe that he emulated Clyde Barrow to a point, is there's a lot of very similar situations to their lives. Both of them were petty criminals at a young age. Both of them, the first time that they went to prison was for Grand Theft Auto, which they didn't call it that back then, but that's what they went. They both pulled a small stint in prison. Both of them had a small group of other kind of criminally motivated fellows and females around them, and both of them died. I think Barrow was 25. And Manzo was 24 when he died. Both of them were very poor. Manzo came from a very harsh background. His dad was a rough character. He was in and out of trouble with the law. Excuse me. His mother was a nefarious sort also, not as bad as the dad. She was trying to do what she could with Manzo, but Manzo was just the problem child. He was the worst of the lot. Manzo had some brothers and sisters, and he also had a brother that was killed later in a card game, and there was some, and I, as I get on into the story, I'll, there was some marriage between one of Manzo's henchmen and Manzo's sister for a short time. And that explained a lot. I just found that out, like, from Manzo's great niece that came to our show this past weekend. So she shared a lot of family information with me. So anyway, that's a little backstory on Manzo. But they engaged a taxi driver. His name was Joe Christian. And it wasn't unusual for people to go back and forth from Kentucky to Virginia. We're right on the Virginia border. And at that time, coal was booming. And so you had a lot of folks that went back and forth. It wasn't real unusual. So they engaged this taxi. Mr. Christian took them across a place called Black Mountain. Now, Black Mountain is the highest point in the state of Kentucky. So they got close to the top, and they faked a fire. Now, where I get all these details from are from court records and newspaper clippings from the trial. And so Mr. Christian stopped the taxi. He gets out. Now, you have to remember, Mr. Christian is probably in his mid-50s. He's kind of a tough character, probably a World War I vet. And these guys trying to rob him were all in their mid-20s, early mid-20s. None of them really big guys. Manzo was a small fellow. But Manzo demanded, you know, when he came out of prison, he went from a petty criminal, kind of like what Clyde Barrow did, to a real hardened individual. And I think it was because of the abuse they suffered inside the prison system. Because when they came out, they went from petty criminal to just very, very hard type individual. So Manzo steps up and we want your money. Now, according to court records, you know, basically how this robbery happened is Manzo got up that morning and told his buddy, the two fellows that were with Manzo were Sherman Klaus and Howard Hensley. Sherman Klaus had been married to Manzo's sister for a short time, and he also went to prison with Manzo for car theft. So they were together on that crime. So when Manzo got out, you know, he was the type of individual that he was going to get respect. So he tells Joe Christian to give him the money. Well, Joe Christian fights back. I surmise from the court records and reading, you know, I've studied this for years, that he basically he clocked me. So he knocked him down. He Manzo took him a good lick. So whenever the Sherman Klaus came out with a knife and he cuts Mr. Christian, doesn't kill him but cuts him fairly well, and then they beat him down. They beat Joe Christian down. Now, the way that the death certificates and the reports read, that Joe Christian's throat was cut from ear to ear with a straight razor. Manzo, now, the only way that you can cut somebody from ear to ear is to get behind them. So Manzo was very upset that this guy had challenged his authority. So Manzo Shepherd walks up behind him. The other guys are holding him. And the guy's, you know, in and out. But, he you know, anybody, if he was very... if he wasn't about knocked out or unconscious, he would have, you know, nobody's going to let you cut their throat. But he grabs Joe Christian's hair, pulls his hair back, pulls his head back, and cuts both carotids and about decapitates Joe Christian on the top of Black Mountain the last week of April 1942. After that, they turn Joe's pockets inside out. They get like $26 is all they got for that murder. Okay, they're covered in blood. They put the body in the car. They take it across the Virginia line, which top of the mountain is the dividing point between Kentucky and Virginia. Drive just a short distance over into Virginia and throw the body over the mountain like a sack of potatoes. Okay, so Manzo, what they're thinking is that the laws back then, unless it was like car theft or something like that, the FBI didn't get involved. It was mostly, you know, there wasn't much communication between the states. So they thought that they would just find the body. Now, these guys aren't they're wannabes, and they're vicious, but they're not the sharpest tools in the shed. So they get back in the car, which is saturated. The seats are saturated in blood because they've had to put Christian's body in it. The arterial spray from whenever they cut his throat has gotten all over them. So they take they bring the car back to Harlan County, or to Harlan, to where that Manzo Shepherd's mother lives. Her name is Mally. Now, remember, they're a rough sort. So he goes in, and Mally Shepherd is later charged with being an accessory to this crime. So they go in and say, "Hey, Mom, we just killed this guy." And they're covered in blood. The car's all bloody. She says, "Give me your clothes." She takes their clothes, gives them new clothes. They get away. And Mally takes the car to a secluded location, burns the car and the clothes. You know, what else are moms for, right? So they're picked up a few days later because they are the last ones that are seen with Joe Christian. They don't have enough evidence to hold them. So, and if you guys get an opportunity to come into Harlan, I can show you approximately where they walked out of the sheriff's office, walked about two blocks, and stole a car. So these guys, instead of going like out west and assuming different names, going to Mexico or whatever, they don't do that. They go and they buy liquor, go find their girlfriends, load them in the car. They also have one of the murder weapons with them, and they take off into Virginia. God knows where they're heading because they get pulled over for speeding outside of Fredericksburg, I believe. And they have, like I said, they're all drunk. They got one of the murder weapons with them. Well, the sheriff there calls back, runs the plates, car stolen, calls back to Harlan County and says, "Hey, we got these folks here in a stolen vehicle. You want to come get them? What's their story?" By that time, they have discovered Joe Christian's body several days later, and it had been a hot, I think the way the paper put it, it had been a sex warm spring. So Mr. Christian's in, he's in pretty bad shape, whenever they found him. His throat's cut, he's bloated. And they take him over into Virginia, actually, to have him prepared instead of bringing him back to Kentucky. So they bring Manzo Shepherd in and his buddies into Harlan for trial. And this is the first trial happens May 19th of 1942. This trial ends in a mistrial. There was a Church of God preacher that didn't believe in the death penalty, and he hung the jury. So whenever they step off and come out from the jury box, the sheriff, whose name is Clint Ball, immediately arrests this holiness preacher for obstruction of justice and takes him upstairs to the jail. Now, in these old courthouses, a lot of times the jail was on the very top floor. And that's where Manzo was held, and that's where his two cronies were held. So 2 days later, they have another trial. during this trial, as the defense, the prosecution pressed, Joe Christian's sister and his nephew, whose name is Jeff Eaton, are standing behind Manzo. Well, they had patted down, searched all the men for guns before they. There were 300 people in the courtroom that day. People, I mean, this is a place where that you have to realize the mine wars are still going on. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the mine wars in Kentucky, but they went from the late 20s, mid 20s, on up to the early 40s. That's whenever that the labor force was trying to organize into the UMWA, you know, joining the UMWA for better working conditions. There were porches blown off, people blown up, people shot on a regular basis. Several battles between company people. Basically, the coal companies owned the towns. They didn't own Harlan, but they would own Lynch, which we will go through if you come to Harlan to go to the top of Black Mountain where this murder took place. You will pass through two towns that coal companies owned until the early 1960s. When you lived in a coal company town, you got to pick. You had they cut your grass, they either cut it for a small fee, or you had to keep it cut, you know, very neat. They painted your house every 2 or 3 years. You had the choice of 2 or 3 colors. If you got out of line, they literally fired you and threw you out of their town. So I'm going to take you through a couple of these places if you happen to, which we'd love to have you to come in and investigate. I can give you a lot of backstory on the toll wars. So, you know, during a time where violence is common, this is a particularly heinous crime, and it's caught the public's attention. It got newspaper play all the way up to New York, into Chicago. It was a big story at the time. So the second trial happened May 21st, 1942. At the closing argument, Manzo, Joe Christian's sister, started becoming distraught. Manzo was, he's not a very repentant type of guy, even in death. I've got several EVPs from him, and he's not the least bit repentant of what he's done. So he turns around and looks over his shoulder and laughs at her. And he turns back, and this is toward the eyewitness accounts and newspaper articles. He turns back around. He's turns back around to face the judge. Jack Heaton steps up, fires the revolver into the back, a 32 caliber revolver into the back of his skull. It traverses through the skull and doesn't exit, but makes a knot in his forehead. He hits the table, flops a little bit because of the contractions, you know, where he's being headshot, and he kind of lays against a partition that's in the courtroom. The judge orders them to take him to Old Harlan Hospital, which is a few blocks away. Now, Manzo Shepherd's dead in a hammer, but the judge was going to make sure that the family got closure. He orders the jury to deliberate. They do so. They come back in around 10 minutes, and they ask him, have they reached a verdict? The jury foreman says, yes, we have. We recommend we find the defendant, Manzo Shepherd, guilty of murder, and we recommend the sentence of death by electrocution. The judge accepts their verdict. He has the bailiff to call Harlan Hospital, and they say, Shepherd's not been dead 2 minutes, Judge. Just has died. So they rendered a verdict on a dead man. So that's about half of the story. What do you think so far?
Hey, Devin, what do you think, buddy?
It's fascinating. I love this kind of thing.
This is nasty. This is just incredible.
Yeah.
Robin, what do you think?
Notice I'm being quiet.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And number one, I think it's fascinating, and I really applaud all the work that went into doing the background on that, because I'm sure that was not easy. As old as it is, that had to be a lot of work for you to go in and get all that information. So I applaud you on that. On my end, here's what happens with me, because we all know I'm weird and freaky. When I start hearing about, and I'm going to be honest, up until today when John told me the guest and what the topic was, I had never heard about it. Okay, so this is all fresh for me to hear it, which I find it, like Devin said, it's really fascinating. It really and truly is. But for me, because I am this weird, freaky person, I get readings off of different things. Now, whether or not they're accurate, I don't have any way of knowing that. All I can tell you is what I get. I mean, even aside from the crime that he committed, this was a very disturbed person. And he heard voices. Like, this wasn't just he was a bad seed. He literally heard voices. Things were talking to him, and they were not good things. They were evil things. And I completely agree with you on what you said as far as the pull and the tie between him and Clyde Burrows. Absolutely. I mean, I think that's dead spot on. But I think there was more to it. Like, he was tormented. And I keep getting, and I don't know if this was somebody in the family. I don't know if this was someone out of the family. But he was abused when he was younger, when he was a kid. And I don't know if that's a public record, if it was from the family or from somebody else, but he was abused.
No, but it's not public record, but his great niece verified that this past weekend, that he was treated very, very badly by his father. Very bad.
Yeah. Yeah, he was violent. He used to, and I keep getting that he was physically abused by this person, but he heard voices. He truly heard voices. And they were dark entities. And a lot of times if you are, and it's not just because it's him, anybody, if you are in a situation, whether it's abuse or whatever, where you have that negativity around you, it's like a calling card for everything else out there in the galaxy that's negative.
Yes.
And John and I have talked about this before. It turns into really, and I'm not saying this to be funny, but it's the best explanation I can give, like a feeding frenzy, like a buffet. Because everything is energy-based, and that's what it all comes down to at the end of the day. And so all these dark entities come flying in because he's radiating all that darkness because of the situation he was living with and the abuse that he was living with. He was not happy by any means. He had a lot of anger and a lot of hostility in him. And it just brings all that stuff to him. But he heard voices, and a lot of the stuff that was being said to him was telling him to do some of the things he did. And that's not to say he's completely blameless. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying he also heard those things, and they were egging him on and telling him to do certain things. And when he killed that person, now I'm assuming that it was Manzo that actually did the killing.
Yes, Manzo did
when you were talking about it. And this happens to me a lot when I hear different things, and I know it's freaky, and I'm sorry. Like, I could actually physically feel the strength that he was using on this person. Like, it was overwhelming. And the hatred he felt, I could feel that. And then right after I felt him doing that, I got the weirdest sensation, like it would be something, somebody, whoever he was doing this to, was gurgling and choking on something in his throat, which in this case would be blood.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very overwhelming and very overpowering. Like, it was almost like he was stronger than what he normally would have been. Like, some unknown freaky thing gave him more strength than he normally would have been.
Well, he would have had an adrenaline dump from where Joe Christian had hit him, and that humiliated him. And then whatever dark stuff was in him. I mean, he didn't have to kill Joe. He didn't have to kill Joe Christian. See, They could have just beaten him and taken the car and the money. And,
right. No, he had every intention to kill. And he didn't even really, it wasn't even about the money.
No, no. When he got up that morning, they said, you know, we're going to go rob somebody. And that's all they would say. Who knows what else they said. You know, Manzo Shepherd got up that day, and he meant to do harm to someone.
Well, when he went up, and I know this sounds really far-fetched and kind of way out there, but I'm going to say it anyway, since we're on a paranormal show.
Yep.
Where he took him up in that mountain, there's a reason it was at that spot. I mean, that whole area that they were in, there's all kinds of stuff there. None of it's good.
Oh, yes, that's true.
Like, whatever was talking to him, whatever was going on with him, it was stronger in that area that they did this.
Yes, a few miles from that place, I have done several investigations. One of them, in the graveyard that we think that we're 90% positive that there's been a lot of ritualistic activity. I had an investigator attack there, and we had the Catholic priest end up blessing it before the activity kind of dropped down. We got some of the most heart-wrenching EVPs I've ever got from that location.
There was a reason it happened where it did. I mean, there is so much negativity there. It's like it's in the ground. It's in that whole area there. It's like absorbed into the earth.
There's been murder after murder after murder on that mountain, and there has been a lot of rumors and panic activity in taking place on that mountain. So yes, you're right.
Okay, that explains what I'm getting then. So what I picked up really wasn't that off base.
No, not the history of that of the area, and I spent years and years and years talking.
Yeah, I had not heard anything about any of this until John mentioned it to me this afternoon. But again, I got to say, I applaud you because, man, you did some work. You really did some work to get the details that you did. That's fantastic.
Thank you very much. I've had a little help along the way, but mostly it's been a lot of time in the library, a lot of time trying to straighten out the facts and fiction. Whenever I first heard the story, the only thing they got right out of the whole sequence of events was Manzo's name, and he killed a guy on Black Mountain. The story that I got, which made no sense whatsoever, was that Manzo Shepherd and his buddies killed a man on Black Mountain. They cut his throat. They put him back in the taxi. They spun his head around to look out the back of the taxi window, the rear glass, put the dude's hands on the steering wheel, and walked off. Well, now, it's several miles to the bottom of that mountain. You're not going to murder somebody and play a high school prank like that with a body. I mean, not that high school or Frank's body, and walk out of there. So, but I took the name and the approximate date he was murdered and started digging from there, and then came up pretty well with this. So
I'd like to say something about the other two that were with him, because there was two men with Manzo, correct?
That's correct. Yes.
Okay, now these guys, they had a very odd relationship with him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, part of it was they were afraid to go against him. Like, they were afraid that Manzo was actually going to hurt them if they did not go along with it.
Right.
You know, the other thing was, you know, they figured they'd get some money out of it. But again, they weren't really, none of them were really in it because they thought they were going to get this big payoff for it. Manzo was in control, and then this entity was in control of Manzo. And these two guys went along with it like they were trying to not really prove anything to Manzo, but it's just like they were told what they were going to do, and they were concerned that if they didn't go through with it, they were the ones that were going to be end up 10 feet under.
I think that I know for a fact that in some of the testimony that Howard Hensley he was the newest member of their crew, and he was scared. He was scared of Manzo. He was buddies with Klaus, Sherman Klaus, and Manzo Shepherd were the harder core of the trio, and Klaus, as soon as the fight started, Klaus whipped out. He had no problem. I don't think this is the first time that they killed somebody, because just as soon as it started going south, you know, Klaus went straight into knifing the guy. Now, I mean, so it's something they've done before.
This wasn't the first time. This is the first time they got caught.
Yeah, that's what I think. I don't think it was the first time. And so when they got caught, it was a lot of finger pointing going on. And even though that Klaus and Shep used to be brother-in-law, that's the tie. That's one of the ties in the sport.
But he knew Manzo from when he was his brother-in-law, and he was afraid of him then.
Manzo, from everything I can gather, was a crazy fellow. He was not somebody that you'd really want to make mad, because his dad, and this is something that that they shared, Miss Kathy had shared with me over the weekend, there were several killings attributed to some of the Shepherds through the years. And his Manzo's dad was in trouble for a lot of petty stuff, and then which I don't think that it stuck, but attempted rape and robberies, and he was not a good sort either. So that was what Manzo had to deal with, and from what she told, that Manzo's father's name was Will. So from what she could gather, Kathy's mom was Manzo, obviously Manzo's sister, and she would tell tales about how mean that Will would be to the kids. So yes, Manzo.
Just like Robin said.
Yes. So that's and I just discovered that this weekend. Now, we'll pick up the story. Now, remember that the defendant sits in a certain chair. Okay? Manzo was murdered in this certain particular chair that came to be known as the death chair for a reason. Now, a few months later, Klaus and Hensley go on trial. Separate trials, same day, separate trials. And they both plead out to avoid the death penalty. And they're both sentenced to life in LaGrange, which was the Kentucky State Reformatory. And now, a few months after that, and I think that their trials took place October of 42. Now, Jack Heaton's trial took place in February of 1943. Now, remember, Jack Heaton killed Manzo Shepherd in front of 300 people in broad daylight, in front of the judge, in front of the prosecutor, and in front of 300 witnesses. Okay?
But what did Manzo have on him?
On Heaton?
Yeah.
Heaton shot Manzo. Because Heaton killed Manzo because he laughed at his mother.
Okay.
He went nuts. Go ahead.
Yeah, I keep thinking that there's more to it. He was worried about something Manzo was going to say. I mean, I don't have a clue what it is, but it just seems like not only what you're talking about, which is what enraged him, but it was something else he was afraid Manzo was going to say.
I don't know.
It could be just something maybe he thought he was going to go off on his mom again. I don't know. I just know that he was concerned about something that was going to come out of Manzo's mouth.
Well, that's what got Manzo killed, was his mouth. That's what, and Manzo, from what his great niece said, he was a very, very belligerent fellow. And he liked to run his mouth. So, okay, we're back to the death chair. Manzo got killed in it. His two cronies got sentenced to life in prison in it. Now, in February of 43, Jack Heaton is sitting in it facing a trial for the murder of Manzo Shepherd in front of 300 people. Well, the prosecution, you know, they just say, you know, they're not really trying to hardball Heaton, not really. They say, you know, Heaton, what happened? And he explains to them, you know, it went dark. I went crazy. I shot him. He laughed at my mother. He killed my uncle. And I shot him. I did it. And then, you know, we went back and forth a little bit. And he goes, look, he laughed at my mother. Everything went dark. I shot him. I did it. I went crazy. And that's all they could basically get out of it, not much more. And
yeah.
So they go, okay. And they ordered the jury to deliberate, obviously, and there was a female jury foreman. I think her name is Miss Frazier. So the jury deliberated around 10 minutes. Came back, you know. Now remember, he's killed this guy in front of 300 folks. And the judge. And he says, Madam Foreman, have you reached a verdict? She says, yes, we have, Your Honor. He says, what is the verdict? She says, we find the defendant, Jack Heaton, not guilty by reason of temporary insanity. Judge
Bang.
Slaps the gavel down and says, case dismissed, Mr. Heaton, you're free to go. Jack Heaton dies of natural causes in Los Angeles, California, 1982.
Oh, wow.
Kentucky Justice. Harlan Justice, anyway. So, what do you think about the Manzo Shepherd story so far?
I think it's amazing. I mean, it really is very interesting to me. You know, I mean, it's a lot more in-depth than, like, if you were to go... And, I mean, I haven't done it or anything, but, I mean, just to go on the Internet, you wouldn't get all the details you have. And all those little details are what makes it such a good story.
Oh, yeah.
And it's all true.
Oh, it's everything backed up by court documents and newspaper accounts. There's nothing inflated, you know. It took me a while to figure out. It didn't take a long while, but, you know, that Manzo... during the fight that Manzo got the worst of it in the beginning, because there was something that just set him off. Where, I mean, they have you know, Joe Christian beat down. They can just leave him lay there, and he probably bled out, or if not, they'd have been many, many miles away before he could, you know, anybody passed by him. Instead, he chooses to walk around and pull his head back and slice his throat. You know, so and then the angle of the wound, in order to sever both carotids, and about decapitating, you know, you're going to have to be behind it.
Yeah.
So Manzo was really, excuse my language, he was really pissed to do that.
Yeah.
And none of that come out, not a lot of it come out in the court records, but you have to kind of think your way through that and go, well, the only way he could have cut his throat like that is to step up behind him and do it.
Yeah. Yeah,
because
I agree.
If you look at the angle that you use, if you slash, like a slashing motion with your right hand, it's more of a 45. I mean, you're going to get one artery, maybe, but it's not going to be straight across the throat, and you for sure can't get it from ear to ear. I have a background in a martial arts and a small background, Filipino martial arts with some knife and stick. And I can tell you, even with a trained individual, you know, you would have to use something like a machete, and would have to hold his head up and stand perfectly still before you could get a cut like that. And I mean, unless you get, so that tells me you had to be behind the guy.
Yeah.
To do it. Had to be.
Well, now, Tony, I got a quick question for you. What happened to Sherman Klaus and Howard Hensley? Did they die of natural causes in prison, or were they murdered, or what?
I've not been able to find. I called the Grange, and there's no record of them getting out. That's still a needle in the haystack I'm trying to find. But hopefully, with talking with, opening up this dialogue with Manzo's great niece, that's one of the things I'm going to talk to her about, is what happened to Klaus. Now, she actually gave me, Klaus was married to Manzo's sister. Okay, obviously we're going to be a part of that. And I have a photograph of Klaus, Manzo's sister, and Manzo's mother. So I'm hoping she can tell me what happened. I don't know, you know, even if this guy had gotten out of prison, would he came back and talked to them? Would he just left? But I'm trying to track him. I've not been able to find a death cert on him either, you know, locally. But I'm still looking. I'm still looking.
Well, that might have been some more Kentucky justice there.
By the way, because now Manzo, one of his brothers, was killed in a card game, I think in the 60s, 50s or 60s. So they were a nefarious bunch. I think there was the girls ended up kind of being okay, and maybe one of the brothers was okay. But Manzo and one or two of his brothers were pretty rough characters, and Manzo being the worst of a lot. Now,
he was really tormented.
I'm sorry?
I said he was just really a tormented person, I mean, mentally.
Yes, he was. In my opinion, he was. Would y'all like to hear about some of the EVPs I've caused Manzo Shepard?
Yeah.
Hey, Devin, you want to hear about some EVPs here?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
I've done a whole lot of investigations inside that courtroom. There's been 20, 25 people die in Harlan County Courthouse. Everything from natural causes to assassinations to murders in the courtroom to murders in the jail, the suicides in the jail. So it's a pretty active place. It's one of the most active places in Harlan County, you know, the evenings and in certain times of the year. But Manzo caught several EVPs from him in 2016. We were on an investigation, and I asked him, does he know who murdered him? And it got, you know, I'm using a spirit box, and it's I'll clarify that I absolutely understand how to use a spirit box, and that it's the frequency inside the white noise is what the entities use to be able to communicate. It's nothing to do with the snippets of radio chatter that may come through. So how that I use this is I make sure that you know, after we do the research on the location, you ask intelligent questions that there's going to be an intelligent answer come back to you that you can document by historic records or facts that you know. So you want to play the statistical probabilities with that. Anyways, I asked Manzo who murders him. I get the reply, and he's real pissy when he says it. He goes, Jack, like that. And you know, it sounds kind of corny, but that's his tone of voice. It's real gravelly.
Yeah.
And he goes, Jack. And that's in 2016. And then I get several more through the time. And unfortunately, I have that one, but I had some more. And I have them. My computer crashed and my hard drive crashed. But I was able to recover most of my audio files. I just have to go through them. And there's hundreds of them. So I still have them. So I'll be able to, you know, I'm getting them and putting them in the proper locations. But also, I've got another one where I said, well, where did you murder him at, man? So what did you do? You know? And he goes, Black Mountain, I dumped him in the woods. So, you know, you're not going to get something on a spirit box or any sort of ITC communication that's going to, there's no song going to be playing, hey, I really like it on Black Mountain, I dumped him in the woods.
Right.
So that, then I got another one from him. Then I said, Manzo, why don't you pass into the light? And he says, that's where the flesh burns. So, you know, he doesn't want to pass on from that. And then some of them, you know, pass. I got several A's and B's, cracked A and B. There's some that if you were using headphones, I would say, what did you do to him, man? So he said, and he would say, I cut his throat for him. And here a few weeks ago, while we were preparing for this reenactment, there was a young lady who went to said, a lot of times he will interact better with females than he does males. So I had her ask who murdered him. And the reply came back, check. So, you know, 4 years apart, well, 3.5 years apart, you get the same response with the same voice.
Yeah.
So there's not a doubt in my mind that Manzo Shepherd is in that courtroom.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Well, he'll come up and he'll touch you and you'll see shadow play. So there's a lot of interesting stuff goes on there.
That's fantastic.
Wow. That's amazing.
And you guys are more than welcome to come and be with me on an investigation.
I'd love that.
We have full access to the building.
Well, Robin, we're not going to be but, you know, less than an hour from Harlan when we're up in Kingsport in 2 weekends.
Really?
So, yeah.
That might be something interesting to think about. I'd enjoy that.
We'll sure hook you up. I mean, it's not a problem.
It'd be something else.
We have full access to the building. I can take you into the courtroom. Now, they refurbished the courtroom, remodeled it, but I can show you within 4 or 5 feet where Manzo dropped, where he was killed at. And I can take you to the old jail, which is on the upper floor, to the cell block where he was held at. And I can show you the route that he walked his last time on this earth to come out of that cell block, walk down some stairs, and then walk into a courtroom to meet his destiny.
Wow, that's amazing. I appreciate you sharing all this with us.
Oh, no, it's not a problem at all.
Well, that's some true crime for you.
And I plan on during the event, you know, and I'm really excited about the events coming up. I'm going to put together a good PowerPoint on Shepherd, and I'll include some of the EVPs at the very end of it. So
oh, great. I would love to see that.
Yeah, that'll be very interesting up there at the Kentucky Bigfoot Conference. At the Tennessee Bigfoot Conference, it'll be really, really interesting. And another thing that's very interesting that I think is that we could actually get in there and see what happened. Now, you know, and I think one reason that I got very interested in this, Tony, was that when I was Horror Hound up in Indianapolis, I met John Borowski, who has written a number of books about serial killers, like Ed Gein. He wrote a book about Carl Panzeram, Albert Fish, H.H. Holmes. And so I got to see, he was my table buddy for 2.5 days. And I mean, it was just amazing hearing him tell some of these stories. And when I heard that you had the story on Manzo Shepherd, I figured this would be definitely of interest to our crowd, because and it also, it's nice that Robin has got some experience and a little bit of a remote contact. And I'll if you want me to, I'll share with you what Manzo told me earlier this evening. You ready for this one?
Yeah.
He said, "Well, I'm in a place where it's evil all the time."
In the jail.
Yeah.
Courtroom.
No, he told me that's where he is now. And he didn't sound like he was. He didn't sound like he was in Harlan, Kentucky the whole time. I'm telling you, it was a little bit creepy. And I said, said my prayers. I mean, because
why he doesn't want to go in the light. That's why he keeps saying the light will burn him.
Well, that's interesting. So, I'll tell you what, Dad, maybe if we can find out a little bit about Jack, maybe you can help us do a little bit of research on Jack, because he's out there in your neck of the woods. He's out there in Los Angeles.
Yeah, that'd be cool. I'd love to try to see what I can dig up.
I need to call Kathy. Yes, Tony?
I have his death certificate somewhere. A copy of it. I will have it. I have it in my notes. It was in L.A. Where he died at was L.A. And how that I know that Jack Keaton, the his mother on the certificate or on the, some of the documents, mother's maiden name is Christian. So that, I'm 99.99% sure that was the Jack Keaton that we needed.
Yeah. Well, we'll. We'll see. We'll try to get that figured out. So, Tony, you're gonna have this all written up in a book for us sometime soon.
I'm gonna start working on it this winter. I was actually working on two books. One was about some of the investigations I've been on, and the other one was gonna be about Manzo Shepherd. We've kind of decided to flip it. I'm just gonna go ahead and do Manzo first, and then. You know, so hopefully that will be out in spring of 2020.
Well, then I'll probably try to get you to come. I'm going to have a little bit of a conference on this exact subject of crime. John Borowski said that he would like to come down to it. I've got two places that are interested in holding it, so I was thinking we'll probably get you down there and you can talk about Manzo. And John can talk. He likes Ed Gein, so he'll probably talk about Ed Gein, or he'll talk about H.H. Holmes.
That's very interesting. I'm very familiar with Ed Gein.
Well, I'm sitting here looking at John Borowski's book that he autographed for me right here in front of me. It says "Dance in the Moonlight," John Borowski.
But
oh wow.
But,
I might have to borrow that one from you, John.
Before we go, I'll give a shout out to some of the, you know, we do have people that help a lot. Thomas is a phenomenal partner. Thomas brings a lot to that. He's helped me some on the Manzo Shepherd story. And actually, Thomas Bob, there's been a short film made about Manzo Shepherd, but Thomas and I are going to make another one, which is historical, more of straight up down historical. And it's on Amazon Prime along with several of our other features. And I can't say enough about Thomas's talent as an editor and a director and things like that, and a Bigfoot researcher. So if y'all want to help kind of support the cause, tell people about us on Amazon. Go to Amazon Prime and check us out. And we just had a reenactment last weekend, and you know, Tom was a big part of that, and also Miss Jennifer McDaniels. She brought all the cast together, and we had and done all the advertising for us. We had over 100 people on the ghost walk, and then we had 80-something people for the reenactment. So I really appreciate her and everybody. Then there's another lady, Miss Lisa Peters, who works with us. She does an awesome job. And then Jennifer Fugit does a great job with research and the camera and stuff like that. So it's not just a one-man show. And I've done pretty well all the research on Manzo, but getting Manzo to right here has taken, you know, it's been a team effort. And I really appreciate everybody that's been involved.
Well, I appreciate hearing all this. You know, like Robin said, you did so much research on this, and I just really admire people that can do that. I've been trying to do some research myself on some ancestry type stuff and history, so I just think it's fascinating. And we really have to, you know, document and pass on these stories, you know, because with time people forget things, and it's just, you know, a lot of history gets lost. So I applaud you for doing that.
Yeah. You know, and another thing, like when it comes to Manzo, and you know, he was hearing, as far as what I feel, is that he was hearing voices. His whole childhood, he heard these dark, negative voices, and people, you know, have been put in institutions and everything else because they hear voices, but it does never solve the problem because, and it's not accepted in science as a fact that there is actually something out there talking to them. It's not schizophrenic. I mean, there is actually an entity that is talking to them. You know, and he's a prime example of that. You know, they get that dark negative entities and energy around them, and they're telling them to do things. And it just, you know, they're already an unhappy child or a person. They've already suffered, you know, trauma. And then that stuff attaches to them, and it just starts talking to them. And then this is what escalates it to.
Yeah, well, I mean, we have a huge homeless population here in Los Angeles, and you see some of the people out there. And, you know, obviously there are things like drug addiction and mental illness, but there's some people that there's something else going on. And we have to, like, open up, you know, to these possibilities, you know, if we're going to try to help people and get this situation under control, because there are – everybody's different. Every case is different, and you can't
– I agree.
You know, you have to take each case by itself and accept all possibilities of what this person's going through.
Well, yeah, and it's like, you know, I've been mind speaking with since I was literally old enough to talk to anybody, but people don't realize that once you mind speak with anything, it opens it up so you can mind speak with absolutely everything out there, and that doesn't mean just what's on Earth. I mean, it's you know, anything through a dimension. It's anything. If it's out there and can talk, it can mind speak with you. And because it's not really something that's acknowledged and accepted, anybody that does hear voices is just automatically assumed to be mentally ill. You know, there's no testing or anything that goes on because I'm not even sure how they would do that. It's whether or not there is really one of these entities talking to them. And I know there are people that are truly mentally ill. I don't, you know, not everybody that's mentally ill is actually legitimately talking to something. But in a lot of cases, that's true. You know, I mean, everything can talk. And
well,
once you are open to telepathy, I mean, everything. Like, you know, for me, you know, by the time I was 3 and 4 years old, I knew the ETs were talking to me. I already knew the Foots were. But it can be anything. It can be your pets. It can be anything coming in and out of a portal in a different dimension, you know, or whatever. But it's true and it exists. And I can remember as a child trying to tell my mom and dad, and my mom and dad were just so perplexed because I acted like a perfectly normal, mentally balanced kid. But yet these things would talk to me, and then they would go to tell me something, and I would finish their sentence before they said it. And they're like, well, how did you know I was going to say that? And I said, well, because such and such said this is what you were going to say. So they knew I wasn't, like, completely lost my marbles, you know. And I can remember being a kid and saying, or as a young adult, and thinking to myself, you know, I'm not crazy in any other aspect of my life. Everything else is normal. I can just hear things talk to me, you know. But, yeah, I think a lot of mental illness is misdiagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, do you think that something has opened their third eye up that gives them a little bit more sensitivity? It leaves them a little bit more with them having a mental illness. With, you know, they may not, they may be more open to negative influence, where somebody such as yourself, with, I mean, your third eye has to be open for you to see and to hear, but you understand the thought process is going to be totally different than, you're going to know what to do, what not to do, what to let in, what
right.
to block. A mentally ill person that has their third eye open is not going to know that. They're just going to react totally differently. You think
exactly.
that has some sort of bearing on it?
I do, personally. And I also think that a child especially, which is when I believe he started hearing things talk to him and things started controlling him. I mean, you know, telling him to do this, this, or this, and, you know, knowing it was bad that they were having him do. And a child has not been programmed yet to believe that none of these things are possible. Whereas we grow into an adult, we're constantly told, you know, this isn't real, this isn't real, it's supposed to be this way. We live in this nice little perfect box. But a child isn't like that. They don't know those restrictions yet. And they don't know the lies that we're told about what is possible and what isn't. So they're open to everything. And I think a lot of these things, not all, but a portion of them attach when they're young. And in his case, because of the abuse, he was very angry as a child, very unhappy as a child. He had resentment towards his sisters. I don't think he hated his sisters, but there was resentment there deep down because they were not getting the same exact treatment he was. I mean, their life wasn't easy by any means, but it wasn't as bad as what him and his brothers went through. And for whatever reason, he seemed to have gotten the worst shake of it. But he was a child. And because he was already in that mental state and had that negative energy all around him, it just brought everything to him. But he wasn't old enough where he had already been told, although falsely, this stuff doesn't exist. And I think
right.
he just figured it is what it is, and this is just part of my life. And I don't think, you know, I think he might have mentioned to somebody here and there, but I don't think anybody ever took him seriously. Or really even actually hurt him when he was trying to, you know, tell people, you know, this is telling me to do this, and there's this, and there's this. And I just don't think people ever acknowledged it or really thought about it.
I wouldn't either because of the background that he's in. You know, he's already been in trouble. He's been labeled as a troublemaker. So they're
yeah.
going to pay little to no attention to him. You know, they're going to
exactly.
think he's making up excuses.
And that anger like, just builds. And when you have anger, sorrow, or anything of that nature, it all comes out around you as a gray or a black. And, you know, the old saying, you know, the light always wins over dark. And that really is the truth because, you know, when you have all that darkness and dark energy around you, it just brings in more darkness. And he would have never had access to anything that would have changed that. Or known anybody that would be able to help him change that to get rid of it. Like, I've worked with a lot of people, and they get the dark entities around them and stuff, and I teach them how to get rid of them and how they can do it themselves. But he would never, and I'm not saying I could have done anything for him, but I'm just saying he would have never had access to that because it's not anything that's proven by science to be helpful. Because as you know, as far as science would be, it was just a, it would be a mental illness. It would be a troublemaker. It would be, you know, he's just rotten. Where in some cases it actually goes deeper than that, and there is things going on. He was like the perfect storm.
He would have been
a
vehicle for them to absolutely use. He would have been a vessel.
Absolutely, and I think they did. And I think whatever was bothering him came from that mountain. And I think that's why, I mean, not just, I think there's more than one thing that was attached to him, but I think one of them came from that area. And I firmly believe that the reason that gentleman was killed where he was, that wasn't an accident. It was supposed to play out that way. Manzo went where he was told to go with him.
That's very possible because they had a specific town in mind, and they had to cross Black Mountain to get to that town. There was no other way to get to it. One way was all that. Unless, you know, they left the state, made a big circle, come in the back way, but the only way to get to the place they were going was Appalachian, Virginia. The only way to get there was to cross Black Mountain through Benjamin Lynch, Kentucky.
Yeah,
so,
and I firmly believe John got that message that he got, because when I was listening to you speak about it, and I was getting different things from him as well, and he didn't tell me the exact same thing he did as John, but it was that kind of a vibe and that kind of a thing. So, I mean, I absolutely believe what John said to be true.
Right.
You know, he's not going to go anywhere. I mean, he's going to stay in purgatory or wherever, because he can do whatever he wants to do there. He can stay as evil as he wants, because that's what these entities wanted from him. They wanted him turned. They wanted him there. And that's exactly what they got. You know, and as a small child, he would have never been in a position, because of everything else going on in his life at that young age, he would have never stood a chance to fight him off. Because, number one, he wouldn't have known what was going on. Two, he was already in a negative, you know, compromised situation. And as he grew up, he felt empowered by that anger and that hatred and that darkness. You know, because he could fight back.
Right. But now, and I think that, you know, with all this going on with him, and when he goes to prison, and it's like when Barrow went to prison, you know, he was sexually abused, and the lore has it that before Barrow got paroled, that he turned the tables on his abuser and he beat him to death with a pipe or a brick. A lifer took the rap for him, so he'd go ahead and get out. I think that Manzo was physically abused, and it just made him darker and darker.
I agree 100%. And I think, too, you know, there was such a fear from his friends as far as to not do what he wanted. And when these things are attached to him and he does create these crimes, you know, the strength, I mean, yeah, the adrenaline makes him hyped up and makes him stronger anyway, but he's like the strength of 10 men. When he's executing what these things are telling him to do, they're helping him. There would not have literally been anybody that could have physically stopped him other than with a weapon.
I think once that Joe Christian hit him, there's something flipped in him. There's a switch that flipped, and that sealed Joe Christian's fate. I think.
I agree.
They would have murdered him if he hadn't have fought. But when he hit. If he'd hit one of the other guys, they might not have killed him. I think when he hit Manzo Shepherd, he signed it because Manzo was not going to be belittled.
I think he went through so much of it as a child that I think as he got an adult, his thing was he was never going to let anybody do that to him again. It was never going to happen. He was finally big enough to stand up for himself.
Right.
He's got all this stuff in his head, and he's just never going to let it happen again because when he was a kid, he couldn't stop it.
I agree, and that's some of the theories I came up with because, you know, when you get in this guy's head, and when you see the photograph of him, you'll see his eyes, and his eyes will creep you out. There's no life in those eyes.
Yeah, you know, it's like they've checked out.
Yeah, absolutely, like he's checked out, right. So, there's a lot of stuff, a little... that little tidbits of throughout the story that keep opening up the bigger story, the bigger picture. It's just not like, man, this guy gets shot at the end, you know. There's a lot of backstory.
So, well, I find it fascinating. I really do.
I will, and like I said, I'm going to put a good PowerPoint together, and you guys are welcome to come to Harlan, and we will go to the exact spot that Manzo was murdered, and if you have time, I'll take you to the spot where he committed the murder. And we have caught, and one person I forgot to mention is Miss Belinda Taylor. She helped me in the beginnings a bit and took a lot of photos of me, kind of documented what I was doing. And went with me on two or three excursions to Black Mountain while I was trying to catch EVPs from Joe Christian. We actually caught EVPs from Joe Christian on top of the mountain. So we can go, if you like, if you want to go to where the murder took place, we can run an EVP session and you can do, you know, maybe contact Joe Christian yourself, because the EVPs I got, I don't know that Joe is strong enough or around enough. It sounded like he was way off, like somebody shouting at you from across the field. But you can make him out, you know. But he's maybe you can pull him in because he's definitely there. He's definitely wandering around on top of that mountain.
Oh, I agree. I think he's underneath. He's definitely where he can do whatever he wants.
So, I don't think Joe, I think Joe Christian, I think he's trapped for some reason. I don't know that he moved on. Nobody's ever saw him. But now, right close to where the Joe Christian was killed, there were several, according to lore, very heinous and very brutal murders in the 20s and 30s.
Well, now, you said they did rituals there?
Yes.
That could be why he hasn't moved on, because there may be something there that from the rituals that prevent him from leaving.
This mountain is huge. The rituals that I know about would happen at the bottom of the mountain, but now they would have happened all over that mountain because it's so secluded, you know.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, if you're going to do a ritual, you're going to want privacy.
Exactly.
So they would have had hundreds of, well, probably literally hundreds of square miles, you know.
Yeah.
Because the way that the hollows run in and out, man, you got, it doesn't, you know, if you're looking at a map, it doesn't look that big. And when I take you up on top of that mountain, and you look out, and you literally can't see a house for miles, you know. And it was even more secluded back then. The roads weren't as good, things like that. But one of the reasons I think there was rituals there at the bottom of that, obviously, is because we found, they had arranged the headstones at this graveyard. It was an influenza graveyard at the bottom of the mountain right before you start up the crossing to go to Appalachia. And they had arranged the headstones around an oak tree, and then they had another larger headstone out from it that looked like they used as an altar. And there was some burnings and things like that. You could tell there was bits of cloth and different things. You know, I didn't see any bones, but there was actually, Belinda was attacked. We went back three or four times because of the crazy EVPs, and they had taken the crosses and turned them all upside down, bringing the graveyard.
Oh, wow.
So, and we have photographs of those also. Belinda documented that for me. And so we go back a couple times, and then we're at the graveyard, and I take it. It's not a huge graveyard, but, you know, it's far enough to where that you get out of eyesight of one another if you go around the curve. And I'd walked on around to check if there's any more crosses, anything unusual. And she starts screaming. Actually, she's just one big screamer. And so I start back, and there's another female investigator. She gets to her. I come back around the corner. She's turned to purple. She literally is freaking turned purple. She can't breathe. So we get her in the vehicle. We're about 50, 75 yards from the vehicle, from her, well, from where she's at. We get her in the vehicle, and we don't know whether she's having some sort of allergic reaction to something. Well, we know she can't breathe. We're going to go try to get her to the nearest hospital, and hopefully she doesn't strangle before we get there. So as soon as we get past the last grave site, it's like that you turned a valve on, and all of a sudden she takes this big, deep breath. She goes, like that. And she starts breathing again. And, you know, obviously we asked what happened. And she says, as soon as you guys left, I heard something moving in the leaves. And she thought it was a squirrel, or she thought it was, you know, a chipmunk or something. And she goes, it kept getting closer, and it was really loud. And I could see the footsteps making impressions in the leaves. And I was so terrified, I couldn't move. And she says, all of a sudden it felt like a hot, wet blanket got thrown over me. And she says,
oh, wow.
I screamed. I was able to scream one time. And and that's what we heard, and that's what we got to her. If she hadn't made a sound, I don't know that it would have killed her, but it would have made her pass out. We wouldn't have known. You know,
yeah.
After that, I talked to another female friend of mine that's at the Catholic Church and tell her about the situation and ask them they perform a blessing, which they do at a later date. And it seemed to calm it down somewhat, but there's still activity there. And see, we passed right by that, going to where Manzo Shepherd murdered Joe Christian. And this graveyard was kind of like a forgotten graveyard. It was used a lot in 1917 to 1919 because of the influenza epidemic. And allegedly there's some mass graves and things there, and a lot of immigrants people just kind of had been forgotten about. So this would be a perfect place. Nobody ever went for it. Nobody maintained it. But I guess the timeline I'm trying to draw is 1918 or so, up in the 1920s was the last people that were buried there that we know of. Okay, so Manzo killed Christian in 1942. So this graveyard could have had some sort of dark activity in it even back then. Who knows? You know, I'm speculating. I can't prove that.
Right, but there's something there.
There's something there for sure. My point is, if you wanted to go down into that graveyard, it's kind of see what you picked up on. It's only like 5 minutes out of the way from the main road to driving to the murder site, 5 minutes out of the way. So, I would really like to know what was going on there, because I think it was a collector. I think that somebody had conjured something up and was using the spirits or whatever that were trapped there, conjured them back up, and was bidding, or I'm fuzzy. That's not my area of expertise. I know a little bit about it, but there was something going on that they wanted to keep those folks trapped there. So
yeah.
For whatever reason they had in mind for them, and they had somebody that something, not somebody, but something. And I know you guys know what a collector is. And I don't know if you ever heard of Bobby Mackey's or any place like that. I've investigated Mackey's, and Mackey's history is completely BS what they tell on the ghost shows. But I will tell you this: in the basement there is a collector. There's something evil in that basement. Because I saw three investigators melt down, but it has damn nothing to do with Pearl Bryant. And Pearl Bryant's head was thrown in the river. It wasn't thrown down the portal to hell. The portal to hell is a drain from the slaughterhouse that goes into the Licking River. But anyways, I don't want to get off topic too far. But but with this, I think it was a similar entity type. The one at Mackey's is way stronger, but I believe it's a collector, and I believe there's something in the courthouse holding those folks there. There's a little girl there. I have a video of a girl moving a ball. I have Shepherd holding back that little girl, and I know I have this CV. I just have to find it. And he goes, you know, where Manzo, are you? Are you here? And then Manzo says, get her. And then he goes, get her. And then this little girl is trying to come up. She makes her appearance once or twice a year, and will talk to you. Just very little, though. And at the end of the EVP, you can clearly hear this child giggle. She goes, and I know I don't sound like a child, but it's just, I mean, child giggles.
Yeah.
And so Manzo is kind of like the boss cat of several of the entities, but there's something there that's keeping all in line. So maybe that's something y'all could help me with, is to kind of figure out what's going on and
sure.
why all those spirits are attached to that place. But now here's the interesting thing about Harlem. It's built on Native American graveyards. Dead on top. It's kind of like what was the show, Poltergeist?
Oh, yeah. I love that movie.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, literally, it is built on Native American graveyards. Several bones, I mean, not several, but bunches and bunches and bunches of skeletons during the construction of Harlem, which original name was Mount Pleasant, were found. They found so many mounds in Harlem. Excuse me, one location in the city, they named it Mound Street. So I have a lot of documentation on that, yeah. And so maybe that's got something to do with all the activity, man. I don't know. So I'm getting out of my area of expertise there. But I have a lot of questions I can relate. Stories and events to you, maybe you can help me solve
it. Sure.
Get to the bottom.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great idea to work together like that. And I've loved hearing all of your stories tonight. It seems like Dr. John may have fallen off the call, and we're coming up here on about 90 minutes, so I just wanted to thank both of you for being here, and I really wish I could be at the Georgia Bigfoot Conference coming up soon.
I know. I wish you were going to be there.
Yeah, well,
yes,
I'm going
to... this is what happened to John last time, too.
Yeah. Well, there's always the gremlins in the system, so sometimes they let us talk, and sometimes they cause problems for us, so... but
yeah.
I appreciate both of you being here, and hopefully we'll have both of you back on ScaryCast again really soon.
I'd love
Absolutely.
To. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It was great to talk to both of you guys. I look forward to seeing you.
Absolutely.
Yes, for sure. I definitely want to make it out there.
I'm going to catch up with you one of these days. We'll catch up at some point. I can't wait to see you though. In Tennessee.
Yes, absolutely. I'll be there, and I'll have a good presentation ready, and then we'll go. And I've got lots of stories to tell if people get tired of hearing about Manzo. And then I would love for you guys to come visit Harlan, and maybe give me some more insight on Manzo, and then maybe some.
Oh, I'd love to. I would love
researching.
To.
Great. Well,
that would be wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you guys very much.
Thank you guys so much. And
and we'll talk to you again later.
Yeah, check out scarycast.com. We'll make sure to get your links up there so people can find more about you and contact you if they have any questions or want to talk. And have a great Georgia Bigfoot Conference.
Okay.